final case for argument is 24-1155, Heritage Alliance v. American Pharmacy Roundtable.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr.
May it please the Court. This Court has been very clear that the determination of whether a trademark is descriptive or certainly highly descriptive requires more than a snap reaction or kind of a gut feeling as to how the mark falls on the spectrum. Instead, the analysis must include evidence of the context in which the mark is used and evidence of the significance of the mark to average consumers in the marketplace before a mark can be labeled descriptive or highly descriptive. In this case, the Board found the iVoter Guide marks highly descriptive based on two factors. First, it dissected the marks and found that the I portion of the mark means Internet. And it based that on two cases, no actual evidence in the record, just two cases. And then it also relied on the fact, which is not disputed, and we don't dispute in the record, that the iVoter Guide is found on the Internet. And using those two, those are the only two kind of factors that...
But how else isn't it... iVoterGuide.com, a voter guide placed on the Internet? Is it subject to another reading as to what it means or what it covers?
I think it could, Your Honor. I mean, whether the I stands for Internet or stands for something else, I do think that...
Well, what else would one construe it standing for?
It could be any number of things. It could be the International Voter Guide. It could be anything that you could substitute for the I. I think. And again, there was no evidence in the record that that was.
Did you present any evidence to the board as part of your opposition as to what the I meant?
No, we did. We didn't. And we think that the burden falls on the board, when determining whether a mark is descriptive, to demonstrate.
But procedurally, we're here on review of your opposition to their registration application, correct?
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
So that didn't create any burden on you as the opponent, as perhaps part of, I don't know, showing your standing or somehow.
Sure.
I guess, bottom line, you don't think you have any burden in that context.
So I think we had the burden of demonstrating that the mark was protectable. And I think our own mark was protectable, correct. And I think we did demonstrate that by demonstrating the long use of the mark, exclusive use of the mark that went unrebutted. That's not in dispute. And there was also declarations that were submitted that supported that the mark was not associated with an Internet voter guide generically, but with Heritage Alliance, now AFA Action. And again, those pieces of evidence did not go rebutted. What happened was the...
But the board found them, and I would have thought could find them, insufficient to be persuasive given who the evidence came from and what associated means, at least for the acquired distinctiveness portion.
Yes, the board found that, but I guess that's where it's important to determine when the board found the marks highly descriptive, again, without really any evidence to support that, it sort of created this almost insurmountable barrier to get over. And that's why this court has said that when you're determining whether a mark is descriptive, the board has to say where on the descriptiveness kind of spectrum it falls. Is it, just a little bit descriptive, or is it in this highly?
Can you just remind me what is the legal standard under which it's important to inquire into just how descriptive it is? We don't have a case of fame, right?
No.
So why does high descriptiveness as opposed to mere descriptiveness matter to the result of rejecting the opposition.
Certainly, Your Honor. So in the Royal Crown case, this court said that when you have a highly descriptive mark, it's a continuum. When you have a highly descriptive mark, you need an extra amount of secondary meaning, acquired distinctiveness, to overcome that highly descriptive hurdle, basically. Whereas the lower on the descriptiveness scale you fall, you probably wouldn't need as much. And so that's why it's important that we have that sort of baseline to determine.
So you think there's an argument to be made that on what's in this record, there's, as Judge Toronto said, a legal distinction between the board's finding of highly descriptive versus descriptive? That's a legal distinction that would carry over into the burden that was ascribed to you on the acquiring distinctiveness?
Yes, I guess our point, Your Honor, sure. I guess our point would be there's no evidence to support that the mark is descriptive at all.
But we're beyond that in terms of the discussion we're having here about the difference between highly distinctive and descriptive. I'm sorry.
And sure, and so that wasn't done, but yes, the it was incumbent on the board to provide support for the highly descriptive category.
What if they had just said everything they said and said, therefore we conclude it's descriptive? Would that have been sufficient for you to lose and them to win?
I don't think that was sufficient because again there wasn't evidence to support descriptive. So
no, but you know that's not the question. The debate we're having here. We're having about what legal consequence highly descriptive and descriptive mean. What's the legal consequence of the difference between those terms?
Sure. So I think the difference would be, I think the evidence that we submitted, the long use of the mark and the declaration evidence, I think could overcome a descriptiveness finding. But once the board found the marks highly descriptive, and this court has said, that's almost long use alone, this court has said, it cannot overcome that. So your long use presumption doesn't help you when it's highly descriptive. So that was kind of the first issue there. And also the declaration evidence, again, as Judge Toronto pointed out, the board disregarded that, which it was, you know, which it could do. But again, if the mark was just descriptive,
I don't think I said that the board disregarded it. Just,
apologize.
Just was not persuaded by it.
Yes, that's correct. So again, I think that evidence would have been enough if the mark was descriptive versus the highly descriptive. Highly descriptive, again, I mean, I looked pretty thoroughly, not that I'm the greatest legal researcher, but I looked pretty hard and could not find a case in which a mark has been found highly descriptive and yet secondary meaning was sufficient to, you know, make the mark nevertheless protectable. I've not seen that case, and I think it's just a very hard, and, you know, we went in through our briefs and we described how there was a point in time when, you know, the TTAB and this court basically treated them as generic, highly descriptive. They were almost sort of interchangeable. Like they just, and while that is no longer the case, there still is not that that issue.
I'm curious about part of your exchange with Judge Prost a moment ago. Is it your contention that the record would only support a finding that your mark is something even stronger than descriptive? Is that an issue before us? Or is the issue before us just whether the record supports descriptive versus highly descriptive?
I think the issue is whether the mark is descriptive at all, and that's the point I'm making. The mark is descriptive if it immediately conveys the service that it provides, and I would submit that on this record there is not evidence that iVoter Guide is descriptive. It's suggestive would be our argument is that it does take some imagination. You need to think what does the I mean?
What did the board think, or what do you think, or what does the law say the difference is between descriptive under your standard? Immediately thinks of some characteristic of the represented product versus highly descriptive.
I'm sorry, I don't know that I understand you.
So immediately, let's one immediately think of a characteristic of the product that's descriptive.
Yes.
If it's immediate, and that's for just being descriptive, what does it take to be highly descriptive?
I don't have a good answer for you, Your Honor, as far as what sort of elevates a mark from being descriptive to highly descriptive, except that there needs to be, you know, evidence to support the fact that it is, you know, it is so descriptive that,
did,
you know, it's borderline generic.
Say anything about what it... When the board got to the acquired distinctiveness component, the board repeatedly relied on the, this is highly descriptive. What did the board mean?
I don't know, Your Honor. And again, I think that's why it's important that the board was required to provide evidence of that and not just sort of say, hey, we... Here's two other cases that found I to mean internet. We're going to dissect the marks, take that I, attach it to voter guide, and say that this is an internet voter guide and find that the mark is highly descriptive. But without that guidance, without that instruction, there is nothing to support what kind of evidence would have been sufficient to show secondary meaning that could have overcome that descriptiveness finding. Would it have been even more years of substantial exclusive use or more, you know, declarations, a survey? I mean, we just don't know, because once that highly descriptiveness tagline gets attached, it really becomes a almost insurmountable.
Can I ask you a couple of probably unrelated to each other questions?
Of course.
There was district court litigation, which is over, right?
Yes,
between
you're
the two sides. Okay. Assume with me for a moment that we affirm the rejection of the opposition. What happens in the PTO then? My understanding, and just tell me if this is right, is that the PTO still has an obligation before registering to ensure that, in particular, Section 2E is satisfied, so that it ought to consider if your marks were descriptive, maybe even highly descriptive, so is theirs. Tell me about whether, what you think about what I just said.
Sure. So I think if you were to affirm, Your Honor, the issue of likelihood of confusion was decided, is my understanding from the board. The other side did not put up argument as to whether the two marks between themselves are confusingly similar.
Section 2E says no trademark shall be refused registration unless it consists of a mark which, when used on or in connection with the goods of the applicant, is merely descriptive.
Yes.
Has nothing to do with likelihood of confusion. Likelihood of confusion is your 2D
correct
attack.
But
the board still has to find that.
Right.
I'm sorry, still has to find that that's not true.
For the IVOTUS mark.
Right now they don't have a registration, right?
Correct.
Right? They have a sort of preliminary approval that published. You filed an opposition.
Sure.
And at least... Is that right?
Well, the point I was getting to was that if you were to affirm, since likelihood of the confusion has been found, then we would have priority and our mark would register and theirs would not be permitted to register because we have priority of use and there's likelihood of confusion, so their mark would not register and the board and the PTAB would not have to get to whether or not the iVoters mark is descriptive. Because
I don't understand. I tried to figure this question out kind of on my own based on what the brief said. I thought it would be registered. If we were to affirm...
Oh, to affirm. I'm very sorry. Yes, if you were to affirm.
There's no objection, my understanding. PTO was going to go ahead and issue the registration.
Yes.
And then following the issuance... I think what Judge Toronto was inquiring about is what happens then? I mean, well, to check their mark would
register because
but then there's a procedure under 1064, right, for cancellation of a registration,
yes.
Which I think, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, under our case law, there's a case here called Australian Therapeutic Supplies that says you kind of, standing's not the right word, but you guys can come in, your client can come in and challenge that for cancellation proceedings.
I think that's right. The mark would be found.
And in that, you could say, they are now registered mark, and I want to get back to that, but
yes.
They were now registered mark, should be canceled because it is descriptive. Evidence, Exhibit A, for why it's descriptive is it cannot materially be distinguished with respect to descriptiveness from the one the board has already found to be descriptive, namely your mark.
Yes, that would be the argument, I think, okay. Your Honor.
But I guess I was actually asking a sort of pre-registration question. My understanding
yes.
is that the board does not automatically register just because the opposition has been rejected.
I think it would, Your Honor, in this case, because the mark has been approved. The examiner has done the examination of whether or not the mark is descriptive, has found it is not descriptive, and is otherwise fit for registration. It has published the mark for opposition, and at that point is when we come in and file our opposition proceeding. And so if our opposition is not successful, then their mark would register, is my understanding of the process.
Do we have the examiner's analysis of their mark for whether it's descriptive in our record? Or
no.
That's not here.
No, okay. Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But is what you're talking about Appendix 47? There's a notice of publication.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that goes to their mark.
Correct.
And they're going to publish it in the Gazette in 2019.
And that's what allowed you within 60
within
days or
30 days.
30 days to file an opposition.
Correct.
But the lack of an opposition does not mean that it has...
The lack of an opposition, it would have registered, is my understanding, Your Honor, without any intervention on our part.
Because of all the analysis the examiner had done prior to this.
Yes, the board isn't involved. The board isn't usually involved until we file our opposition proceeding. It's just between the examiner
but
and...
Something new has happened between the examiner's analysis and now, which is, again, on the assumption
mm-hmm.
that this is being affirmed. There's now a ruling that something that is very, very similar to their mark is descriptive.
Mm-hmm.
That's new.
Correct, Your Honor. I don't know procedurally exactly how that works, to be honest, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Proceed.
If it pleases the court. So I want to take on the issue that was discussed and was really first discussed in the reply brief, that their effort to demonstrate acquired distinctiveness was scuttled, if you will.
Well, can you start with where we ended off here about, do you know anything more about the proceeding?
I do not. What counsel said sounded right to me, but I can't confirm that from my own knowledge.
I just want to mention, I happen to be looking at the calendar for this week. There's another trademark case on the calendar. The director is intervened and made a point citing some aspects of the TTEP and maybe something else, that the fact that an opposition has been rejected does not automatically mean that the application will be registered, because if there is a reason to think that the Section 2E restriction, no descriptiveness, is not met, then that determination can still be made. it's not an automatic registration. This doesn't ring any bells for you?
I don't have a view on that, Your Honor. I'll take on whatever you want, but my plan, which always is disrupted on appeal, is to discuss first the argument that the reason that acquired distinctiveness was not established was because of the high standard that was created when the board ruled that it was highly descriptive, and that's just not correct. First of all, I believe there was a burden on the opposer to have the court rule whether this was merely descriptive, suggestive, highly descriptive. The board doesn't have a burden in an opposition. The burden is on the opposer. And they needed to come forward if they thought it was merely descriptive or suggestive with evidence. Instead, when they got to the acquired distinctiveness issue, at that point they didn't know what kind of standard we were looking at, whether it was.
Let me ask you, is your view that under the law, whether there's no distinction, if the board had found merely descriptive versus highly descriptive, there's no change in what the burden is in terms of acquired distinctiveness?
That's not correct. There is a change.
Oh, okay. There is a difference.
It's an important change, yes.
Okay, there's a higher standard, because that's what I understood the board to be doing, although the board seems to, without explanation, use interchangeably merely descriptive and highly descriptive in its opinion, throughout its opinion. But it did ultimately, I think, at 20, conclude that because it's highly descriptive, there's an increased burden.
Correct.
Okay.
But my point is that regardless of the burden, that the opposer didn't meet it. And that's because of the Converse case that the board set out. Converse is a six-factor case. And as the board noted on page 21 of the appendix, they didn't even present any evidence on four of the factors.
This is six factors for acquired distinctiveness.
Correct.
I need to go back one step. Tell me the difference between merely descriptive and highly descriptive.
As far as the definition?
Exactly.
Yeah, I believe the best definition is in the algae case on page 18 of my brief. The record establishes that the wording directly and immediately identifies significant features of the goods without requiring thought or imagination to discern the nature of the goods. And that's a quote from In re Hikari Sales, which is on page 18 of the brief, of our brief.
That would be highly descriptive, and what would leave something just descriptive as opposed to highly descriptive?
That, something less, you know, something that you have to give thought to, that it doesn't come automatically, but it still is suggestive, if you will, of the goods and services. But I don't have a merely or suggestive quotation because none of that was an issue below, and because, again, with the burden being on the opposer to say, wait a minute, that's not highly descriptive, that is X.
What authority would you cite to support that they had a burden as opposer?
Sure, that is Hoover. What do we have here? I'm sure I have Hoover. This on 238 F3rd, 1357. So I believe Hoover stands for the proposition that the burden is on the opposer on all issues, just like it would be in a plaintiff in a civil case. You know, your burden is every issue you have the preponderance that you have to carry. And as as it was noted in the decision, the only clear piece that they submitted was the length of use. 5 years, 17 years, whatever it was. The second piece that they tried to use were the declarations, and whatever the value of those declarations, obviously the board was disappointed that it wasn't a representative sample or even a bunch of customers, that it were self-selected or selected by the opposer. But regardless, there's still four missing factors. And the converse case says you have to weigh all factors.
This is for acquired distinctiveness.
Correct. I'm
right.
Still on
exactly. Right. So this is I guess, what I want you to focus on. In the portion of the board's opinion in which the board is doing the acquired distinctiveness analysis, there are repeated, I don't know, four, five times when the board says, importantly, because this is highly descriptive,
yes.
blah, 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 these bits of evidence that they have aren't going to be very persuasive. And I'm trying to figure out what, that makes me think that the, determination that this was highly descriptive affected the outcome, okay? And we don't know whether the board, in the absence of that determination, would have reached the same result. So now I want to focus on how the board came to its determination that this was highly descriptive.
Okay.
And that, I guess, is what I want to understand.
Okay. Well, going back to that last point, you are correct that the entire analysis of acquired descriptiveness by the board was under the rubric of that they had already decided highly descriptive.
Right.
My point is that if you looked at the case law, they failed regardless. And so I believe this court could look at the converse case law.
The board never said that. The court never analyzed that and said under either standard it would be, they still haven't provided sufficient evidence. So we have to decide the question of whether it was merely descriptive or highly descriptive, right?
No. Because either way, under converse, they failed. So,
that's your assessment. That may be our independent assessment, but that's not, my question is, has the TTAB made that assessment? And I think the answer is no, or at least if you can show me in the opinion, I'll look at it.
You are correct, but what you're suggesting maybe is a remand to TTAB to, if you find that it's not highly descriptive, then now we have to go back to TTAB to determine this evidence that was deficient under converse, that was deficient under highly descriptive, and say, hey, take another look at this. And I don't think that's an appropriate ruling by the court. The evidence is here. Is it sufficient to establish acquired distinctiveness? And
is the determination of whether something has acquired distinctiveness or not a fact question or a law question?
Fact.
Okay, so that means because the board has not determined as a matter of fact that in the absence of highly descriptiveness, there would still be no acquired distinctiveness. For us to do what you're saying would mean we would be deciding a fact and we can't do that.
Well,
right, that's like okay. Actually, that's Chenery law from almost 30 years ago.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
So focus on the acquired distinctiveness. How did the board get to its determination that this was highly descriptive?
So highly descriptive, by necessity, refers to the product. Okay, it's the product. It's a descriptive of the product. And what was before the board was example one, 271 of the appendix. 271 of the appendix, it's a joint appendix, shows the product. So now, does iVoter Guide refer to a product that is a voter guide on the internet? Now, if the only thing on the internet was an opportunity to purchase or to acquire a voter guide, it wouldn't be highly distinctive because the product is out there. It's not on the internet. To be highly distinctive, the product has to be part of the internet.
Highly descriptive.
And so you look at 271. This is their product. This can only be on the internet.
So is it possible that the distinction between descriptive and highly descriptive is something like this? A mark can be descriptive in the sense that it describes even just some minor feature of the product. Called red, but the product is a ball. That may not be a good example. The definition that you have on page 18 of your brief from the TTAB's, Hikari sales, you call it the algae wafers, talks about immediately identifies significant features of the goods.
Yes.
So is it about the description of something, a truly significant feature of the goods, which is why it approaches the name of the goods?
Yes. Well, it has to be significant. I mean,
And in this case, perhaps, there's no distinction. For this to be descriptive, what it's describing is, in fact, the entirety of the good.
Yes.
Okay.
And since we're just using words, it's confusing. The word used interchangeably, highly descriptive and merely descriptive. Are they sort of one and the same? Merely descriptive means that there's nothing else there. It's a merely, and that's, well, am I wrong that they use those terms interchangeably?
I don't believe they used them interchangeably because I don't believe they ever referred to iVoter Guide as merely descriptive. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you're wrong.
Appendix
19, the opposer does not proffer any impression contrary to the descriptiveness of the individual parts. Each of the terms, blah, 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 retains its merely descriptive significance. And it's a discussion of, when it reaches the conclusion of highly descriptive, the title is Analysis of Mere Descriptiveness.
Okay.
So you think there's a difference between mere descriptiveness and highly descriptive, or in context it could be the same thing?
I don't see how they could be the same thing.
What's the difference?
Because of the merely descriptive does not satisfy the algae test. That when you look at it...
Well, merely descriptive to me means there's nothing other than a description. And maybe the board was saying that makes it highly descriptive because there's nothing else there. I'm just trying to reconcile what the board did.
It's hard to reconcile because we know that the burdens for distinctiveness depend upon whether it's merely or highly. So there must be some distinction. But in this case...
Hearing is that there are two ways in which there might be a difference. One, look at what's in the mark, and the other is what's in the product. And you seem to have a case, I think the board effectively did find, what's in the mark, the entirety of this mark is descriptive. I think that's what maybe Judge Prost was just talking about. And also, what it describes is the entirety of the product.
Right. It just didn't click in my mind with the word merely with what you said. But it's exactly what you said, that the mark itself shows that it's highly descriptive. And then when you combine that with the product of the associated with the yes, my time told associated with the mark, then it I think in this case had to become highly descriptive because there's no other explanation for the I in front of the voter guide. You asked, what else could it mean? And there was stumbling there because there is nothing. And there was nothing in the record. More importantly, they had the burden. They needed to come forward back at the TTAB and say, oh, I could also mean interstate or whatever, and they fell down. So the burden of proof here, I think, is extremely important.
Can I ask just one more question? In your brief, I'm unclear on what you think the standard of review is for the highly descriptive conclusion from the board. At page 9, you say TCAD's determination of highly descriptive is not reviewable. But at page 8, you say the court reviews de novo a finding of TTAB regarding whether there was substantial evidence before it to make a finding of highly descriptive. Those seem like very different standards to me. Which is it?
So your determination, de novo, is whether there was substantial evidence. It's not weighing the evidence here to determine whether it was substantial or not. I mean, to whether it was sufficient to make the finding. So the standard of review is, was there sufficient evidence before the agency to make that determination? And that's it. If they make a legal, a finding, of course, that's de novo. It's always de novo on review. I hope that clarifies, but it was just a lot of space between statement one and statement two in that reason.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. One point I wanted to make with my remaining time is when we're determining whether or not the mark is descriptive and the evidence that is required for that, the type of evidence that typically is used are things like how the mark is perceived by consumers, and you can grasp that through dictionaries or online evidence or journals, newspapers. None of that is here. Now, in the cases where the board found that the I meant internet, there were two cases. The Zenovo case, that was a TTAD case where it found that the I meant internet in the iTool context. But in that case, there was a ton of evidence of what I've just described, talking about how iTool and I are internet objects, things that ordinary consumers perceive as such. And
so is it your argument that the burden never occurred in production, if it was, never shifted to you, you didn't have to do anything because what they came up with was so weak and didn't do it, that you didn't have any burden to come forward with any alternative uses, as you mentioned here, could have been international or whatever it is you said?
I don't believe it was our burden to show that there was an alternative use of I. I think it was our burden to show that we had a protectable mark, and to the extent that we were required to show that, again, I think the long, extensive, exclusive use, going back more than a decade, together with the declarations, I think was sufficient to overcome that part of the burden. But as far as whether the mark is descriptive, I don't think determining whether or not the mark is descriptive. Again, this was never really a issue between the parties until it became obvious to the appellee that they were going to lose on the likelihood of confusion issue. The fight had always been in the district court and elsewhere had been, is there likelihood of confusion? Which party was using the mark first? And once that issue got decided in appellant's favor, that's when the pivot happened to descriptiveness. Because again, I think as you all kind of rightly touched on, if iVoter Guide is descriptive, then how is iVoters not descriptive? And it would seem pretty unfair that the senior user, iVoter Guide, would have a descriptive mark that loses this opposition, while the iVoters junior user of an equally, if we're going to call it descriptive mark, would be able to proceed with a registration.
Well, we don't know the answer to that.
Yes.
That's why we were asking the questions. Yes. You didn't seem to indicate in our earlier discussion that you know that to be true for sure.
I don't know for sure, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. If there's nothing else.
Thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceeding for this morning.